Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Events with Benefits, a podcast that is designed, if you are working in the not-for-profit or fundraising raising space, the podcast has been designed to get your profits up and your stress level down. Don't know if that's going to happen here today. This is Danny Hooper, I'm your host, kind of quarterback for the podcast and also chief of security, but today we're going to find out about some of the potential legal pitfalls that can affect your fundraising event.
So I met Mary Tavella Downling at the Cause Conference this year. This is Renee from Donation Match. And she provided so much good information about legal considerations in your fundraising. She's an attorney for purpose law that I knew we had to bring her on board to share this with all of you. I personally wrote a page full of notes, scribbling in my margins on everything that she was enlightening me about. And I think everyone here is going to learn something new and potentially money-saving.
Now, our podcast, as always, is coming from the world headquarters of Windspire in Orange County, California, and joining us again today, our Director of Marketing, Ian Loth.
Thank you, Danny, and pleasure to be here as always. I know this conversation was especially enlightening for me, considering all the raffles that nonprofits do and that we help nonprofits do, using our travel experiences as prizes. But I had no idea the legal ramifications or considerations that a nonprofit should have and steps they should take before running a raffle, just so that they don't get in any sort of trouble. But tremendous amount of information that we covered here today. This is a jam-packed episode. Everything from, considerations before you run a raffle, how to handle your volunteers, the alcohol at the event, lots of liability there. As Danny said, this might make you sweat a little bit more than some of our other episodes, but it's definitely very, very important information before you go ahead and start organizing your event.
Well, knowledge is power, so let's get started.
Well, our very special guest today is Mary Tavella Downling. She is an attorney based in San Diego, and you may be wondering on our podcast here, Events with Benefits, why we have an attorney on the show today. And that's because we live in a litigious world, and we're going to address the question today with Mary. Mary, do organizations in the not-for-profit space, do they need to be concerned? Are there liability issues? Are there things that we need to be concerned about?
Sure, absolutely. Well, first off, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity, and this is always such a great platform to talk to nonprofits about, preventative things and preventative measures that they can implement before getting into hot water, into a litigious mess. As a result of them just trying to further a charitable cause and fundraise and hold events to further whatever their charitable mission is. So it's definitely a consideration. And for many of my clients, they come to me prior to getting into any kind of litigation or any type of legal pitfall to make sure that they're doing everything that they can to comply with state, federal, and local laws, to ensure that they're doing what they need to do to be compliant and not get in hot water, whether it be with the Attorney General, with the Secretary of State, with the IRS, or the Franchise Tax Board. So I think one of the biggest misconceptions about nonprofits is that they're not operating like any other for-profit business, and that's just really so untrue. There's a lot of legal hoops and pitfalls that they have to be aware of prior to engaging in any type of fundraising event.
All right, and what might some of those the most common pitfalls be, and maybe you've got some examples you could share with us?
Sure. So I would say if I could give listeners any one, piece of free legal advice, it would be make sure you have an insurance policy. So many times I have clients come to me after they had a fundraising event, and maybe it was someone from the general public attended the event and they fell at the event, or there was some type of there's some action that happens after the event, and trying to defend a lawsuit of something that happened at that event will really just drain the assets of the nonprofit itself. So making sure that you have a general commercial liability policy that can cover anything that may happen at the event is so important. With those riders, another important thing is to make sure that your insurance policy covers volunteers. One of the most common, as you probably know, nonprofit organizations are primarily run by volunteers. And a lot of insurance policies, you want to make sure that those policies cover any of the acts of those volunteers during your events.
All right. We talk about insurance. Can you give us just some idea of what the costs might be related to obtaining insurance? Is it prohibitive or?
Sure. Just like anything, your insurance cost is going to depend on the nature of your organization and the size of your organization. So typically when I'm forming a new nonprofit and we're seeking 501c3 status, you have to create, which a lot of listeners are probably aware of, they've already gone through this process, but you have to set forth a budget to the IRS of past, present, and future activities, and from a financial standpoint as well as a narrative standpoint. If you're a small startup organization, you can absolutely get a very good, solid commercial policy for under $2,000 a year, which is really not that much. Mm-hmm. Of course, as your organization grows and your programs expand and you have more employees, you need to think about getting more of those different riders on that policy, and maybe it's employment practices. You should absolutely have directors and officers in errors and omissions for directors and officers insurance. And of course, as you start adding on some of those riders, the cost of that insurance policy is going to increase.
Okay. Mary, do people need to seek out the advice of an attorney prior to hosting an event, or are there checklists available that they can download or have available where they can step through themselves all of the considerations?
Sure. I mean, obviously, coming as legal counsel myself, I'm going to tell you, yes, come see me before you have an event. Go see any kind of legal advice to make sure that everything that's occurring at your event is legal with the state, local, and federal levels. Everything down from permitting with maybe a local agency, to making sure you have your insurance policies, to ensuring that you have a strong written contract in with maybe any of your corporate sponsors. One example that I have that many clients come to me for are corporate sponsors at their events. Maybe they're offering booths or packages for free tickets for a corporate sponsor and in exchange for a corporate sponsorship. You want to make sure that all of that is memorialized in a written contract. Of course, no one intends to have a legal dispute. And, when you first enter into a business transaction with another organization or another business, you do so because you're all on great terms. That doesn't always happen. You want to make in the end, you want to make sure that the intent of the parties are very clear from the get-go, and it's memorialized clearly in a written contract, so that in the event there is a dispute, there's a clear pathway in how to resolve that dispute without draining the resources of either party, whether it be your corporate sponsor or, of course, the nonprofit themselves. There are a ton of resources that are, free resources, of course, that you can go on and Google and seek other nonprofit organizations that cater to other nonprofits to help them with some of these resources. So, of course, I would never discourage a nonprofit from seeking any, depending on their resources, seeking any of those free resources. But get it wherever you can. You definitely should take care of all of these issues before getting in hot water, rather than having to come from a defensive standpoint to try to fix it.
Mary, as a fundraising auctioneer, I am always concerned about the alcohol at an event. And, I see situations from time to time where the organizers will take a bottle of champagne to the table of a successful bidder on one of the live auction items. Always have wondered, are there risks associated with alcohol at an event? And I always think the worst case scenario, somebody getting into their vehicle, leaving an event after they've been given free alcohol in that kind of a scenario.
Absolutely. That's a great question. Anytime alcohol is involved, of course, there's risk involved. So absolutely, it's a consideration that at some of these galas, especially when they're giving away alcohol free of charge many times, there's overconsumption considerations that the nonprofit absolutely needs to have. A lot of times nonprofits can cater to this concern by doing drink tickets to limit the consumption, so at least it can show that the nonprofit is taking steps to ensure that there isn't, they aren't over-serving, to avoid overconsumption of any of the donors that are, potential donors that are attending the event. But there are also additional considerations in making sure that you're having vendors that are carding and you're not serving to anyone under the age of 21. And then additionally, there can be some disclaimers that you put in the tickets when prospective donors sign up to attend these events. There is disclaimers that you can put on those tickets to make the donors aware, and really just show that the nonprofit is doing everything that it can to be responsible in these types of events.
Okay.
Mary, this is Ian Loth from Winspire here. One thing that we see that can vary by state oftentimes is things like raffles, where there are various regulations that need to be addressed. Have you experienced that or have any experience with it?
Yes, raffles are huge, especially in California. And I think there's a big misconception with nonprofits that if you're a nonprofit, you can just engage in raffles. And that's not necessarily true. And the penalties for failing to comply with California state laws with regard to raffles are really steep. So anytime you intend to engage in a raffle, there are requirements, registration requirements that you have to adhere to with the California Attorney General. So the California Attorney General Department of Charitable Trust, Registry of Charitable Trust, is responsible for the oversight of all nonprofit charitable organizations in the state of California. And they have registration renewal reports, raffle registrations, registrations for commercial co-ventures. And many times these registrations and renewal reports require you to register with the Attorney General prior to engaging in the activity. Failure to do so will impose penalties on your organization, and it may even impose penalties on your individual directors and officers for negligence, for failing to adhere to the law and be aware that there was registration requirements.
Well, so what are the timelines like here, and how far in advance of the event date do these organizations need to be doing this kind of homework?
So the very first time that you do it, it depends on, you have to register by November of each year. But of course, maybe the nonprofit is not anticipating that they're going to engage in a raffle. So many times it's 3 months before they engage in any type of raffle activity. But again, if you're going to have the raffle, it's never too late. Just seek compliance. The Attorney General and the state agencies are really big on transparency. So even though there may be penalties, it's always in the nonprofit's best interest to, if they find that they're not in compliance or that they failed to register, it's never too late. It's still a better practice to register with these agencies and maintain full disclosure of the money that's coming in and the money that's going out and how that money is being used. That's what the Attorney General is most concerned about. They're concerned that these nonprofits, they're displaying and expressing to the general public that they are soliciting charitable funds to further their charitable, educational, scientific, their exempt purpose. And they want to make sure that any of the money that collected is actually going towards that cause. So if the nonprofit has the intent of transparency, full disclosure, this is where the money is going, it's always better than just not disclosing or not registering, even if you've done it late.
And does that apply only to public raffles where you're selling tickets publicly? I know a lot of events out there, they'll have, you know, raffles at the event once people have purchased tickets for that. Does that apply there as well?
It's any raffle. So a raffle is deemed as gambling. So any for-profit business is not allowed to do it. The reason why you're allowed to do it is because you are a nonprofit. So it's kind of an exemption under the law. So any type of raffle that you're going to engage in, where you're selling a ticket in exchange for a chance to win, that's deemed to be a raffle. And then you'll have registration requirements, regardless of how big or small that raffle is going to be.
So Mary, this is Renee, and I know that many organizations, obviously this applies to all states in the U.S., and I'm sure Canada may have some equivalents. But here in California, I've heard that many organizations, rather than holding a raffle, will try to do a workaround with an opportunity drawing. Can you address the differences?
Sure. So an opportunity drawing, like I said before, a raffle is defined when you are offering a ticket for something of legal value in exchange for a chance to win. An opportunity drawing is when you're not charging for the ticket, and that's not deemed a raffle. There's no registration for that. So that is kind of a workaround. But I would say kind of a pitfall that I've seen clients fall in before is the sale of the ticket does not always have to be for money. If you are exchanging anything of legal value, so maybe that's membership to your organization, or maybe it's services, or maybe it's goods, that's still consideration. So if you're going to do an opportunity drawing, okay, fine. But make sure that there is nothing of legal value being exchanged for that chance to win.
So what would you say to a nonprofit event planning team who maybe has an event coming up in a month or a few weeks, and they've had very successful raffles before, but they haven't really gone through the steps of planning for this sort of thing? What would you recommend to them?
Sure. So first and foremost, I would say, speak to your legal counsel, whether it's your in-house counsel or your outside general counsel. That would be your first step. The second step would be check, and again, this is California law. Every state is different. Every state has a different law with regards to raffles. So check with your attorney general or your department overseeing the charitable trust. In some states, that's the Secretary of State, and see what the requirement is for reporting requirements and registration requirements. What are the deadlines? When do you have to register? Do you have to file any kind of follow-up reporting mechanism to show how much money you made off the raffle or what you're going to do with the money for the raffle? Are you compensating individuals to carry out the raffle? These are all considerations that the nonprofit should have in the back of their head. And then also, if they're going to bring in any other kind of corporate partnerships, do you have a contractual agreement so that the intent of all of the parties is very clear from the get-go before this event is put on? And make sure that that contract that you have between all constituents of the event is very clear and clearly sets forth any dispute resolution in the event one may arise.
Got it. Thank you. I actually have another question for you regarding the items and soliciting those in-kind donations that people use as the raffle prizes, and of course auction and other giveaways. So, with Donation Match, we're actually very diligent on making sure that whoever is soliciting those donations through our system is authorized by the nonprofit itself. But what types of agreements or protections can the nonprofit themselves take to make sure that only people they authorize are able to go out there with those types of solicitation letters or even asking for money or product on their behalf?
Sure. So in California, there's two different kind of legal terms of art that touches on, and it's really professional fundraisers and commercial fundraisers. These are two areas that the Attorney General really regulates, especially in California. And any time that you are compensating an individual to solicit contributions on your behalf, whether it be an employee or an independent contractor, depending on what they're doing, you have to have a contract with that person in place, and that contract has to be disclosed to the Attorney General. So that's probably the main contract that needs to be in place. And of course, there are some exceptions to this because this is a very complex area of law. That's probably the most important. How much are you compensating this person to solicit donations on your behalf? Are they getting a percentage of all of the donations that you raise, or is it a flat fee for a certain period of time? How long are they representing you? It's really important, especially from a legal standpoint, that you understand if this is another business that's soliciting donations on your behalf, which employees are authorized to act on behalf of your nonprofit, because any action that they do, there may be vicarious liability and it may subject your nonprofit to liability. So again, you want to clearly set forth all of this in a contractual agreement if you're going to engage in any kind of professional fundraiser or paid fundraiser, and make sure the intent of the party is very, very clear, to try to protect yourself from a legal standpoint, before anything, you know, kind of goes awry, and if they engage in any activity that you didn't authorize from the get-go.
Okay, perfect. What about volunteers, though? I think the majority, like you said, of the people soliciting donations are actually volunteers, very well-meaning parents at schools. Are there any specific, you know, anything that maybe the organization, the PTA or the charity can specifically share with their volunteers who are helping them solicit donations to know that,
absolutely,
you know, they may be subjecting the nonprofit to those types of liabilities, reporting, of course, tax receipts, things like that, just to make sure that all their volunteers are very clear about what they're doing?
Absolutely. Renee, policies and procedures for nonprofits are huge. In my practice, we oftentimes are drafting volunteer agreements and policies and procedures for volunteers of nonprofits. Again, you may not have any reporting requirements to the Attorney General if you're not compensating these individuals, but it doesn't mean that they can't subject you to, you know, any type of legal recourse in the event that that volunteer does something that's in violation of the law, because they're still acting on behalf of the nonprofit. So policies and procedures to show that the nonprofit has, you know, steps to take in the event that they do violate the law or they're acting outside the ordinary course of business for that nonprofit, and volunteer agreements, so that you're clearly setting forth to this volunteer, this is what we expect. We appreciate your time and your efforts in furthering our charitable cause. But these are the boundaries, and this is what's important to our nonprofit to keep our charitable assets safe. And then the other really strong point in that, again, is your insurance policy. Make sure that it covers volunteers. Ask your broker when you're renewing your policy, is our commercial liability policy going to cover volunteers? That's very important because they're not an employee. So it's kind of in this, you know, gray area of law, are they actually an agent on behalf of the organization?
All right, very good. Mary, just wondering, are there considerations that an organization needs to have if they're having a fundraising auction, considerations they need to have as far as hiring a professional fundraising auctioneer who perhaps is being paid a flat fee or a commission or a combination of both?
I would say, just like any employee that you're hiring, make sure you vet the individual. Make sure that that auctioneer fits within your mission, understands your mission, and understands, you know, kind of the culture of your organization. So make sure that it's a good fit, because that is your nonprofit has a brand. And any person that's going to speak on behalf of your organization is going to affect the public's perception of your brand. So that's something that's extremely important. And then, of course, just like any other employer-employee relationship, make sure you have a contract. I can't say that enough. Contracts are so important.
But the auctioneer is being hired to solicit funds on behalf of the organization, are they not?
Correct. They are. So you would be deemed a professional fundraiser. And again, that contract, there's specific provisions that the California Attorney General requires you to have in that contract. And a really great resource is the Attorney General website. And they have samples of these provisions that have to be included in that contract.
Very good.
Yeah, I thought it'd be good to reiterate here that, you know, a lot of what Mary's talking about here is for specifically for the state of California, and it can change pretty dramatically from state to state, as I'm sure you well know, Mary. What can you say about, tax write-offs? I know you're not a tax attorney, but is there any considerations when nonprofits are advising their donors after the events about how much they can write off?
Absolutely. So a lot of times there is a contemporaneous written receipt that donors generally ask the nonprofit for. Anytime you get a lump sum of money over a certain amount, you have to give them a donor receipt to substantiate the donation. A lot of times where nonprofits run into trouble with this would be at galas or fundraising dinners, thank you donor appreciation dinners. Anytime that you give the donor something of legal value, they'll try to write off the whole ticket price, which is not correct. Anytime you give the donor something of legal value, you have to back that out of the deduction. So it's important to be able to value, are you giving them dinner? Are you giving them drinks? Are you giving them, you know, a package of t-shirts and, you know, your nonprofit swag? What are you giving them? And any of that fair market value has to be backed out of the deduction. That's something that you're giving to the donor. And so the law sees it as they can't take a deduction. That's two bites out of the apple. So you have to back that out. So I think that's very important. And a way that the nonprofit can cover themselves is, although you're only required to give donor receipts at the end of the year, do it on a monthly basis or on a biweekly basis. Make it a policy of your nonprofit to really closely implement an easy way to track your donors and substantiation of those donations that you're receiving, and explicitly put on the donor receipt, you received, you know, this and a fair market value for, you know, dinner and drinks and this, and your donation was valued at this amount. So it's very clear and there's no confusion to the donor how much they can deduct.
Is that not also a case for stating the value of your live auction items in the program?
Same thing, absolutely.
So we're stating the value of an item, particular travel package, maybe $5,000. It sells for $7,500. My understanding is that the purchaser, the buyer, the successful bidder, can write off the portion. Is that correct? The portion above the stated
difference.
Value?
Correct, absolutely. You're right on.
And what if it sells for, so a good example here is with consignment travel packages, which is what we do here at Winspire. So there's the nonprofit cost of the package, right, which we are selling to the nonprofit, and then there's kind of a suggested retail. Would the price that would need to be backed out of the end donation be the cost that the nonprofit paid for the package?
Yes. And, you know, it's a fair market value, which is always such a kind of arbitrary term for people to understand. So the fair market value is what a willing buyer is willing to sell to a willing or what a willing seller is willing to sell to a willing buyer. So what am I willing to pay you for that package? So, yes, it's your cost. What could you sell it to? If you were a for-profit and you were selling that same package, what would you sell it for? What would someone of the general public be willing to pay for that package? So that's exactly right.
Okay. Mary, you are so engaging, and this is fabulous information. I know we could continue to talk for hours, but what would the takeaways be for our listeners here today on this particular podcast when it comes to legal considerations?
Sure. So I think, again, I know I'm beating a dead horse here, but contracts, contracts, contracts. Make sure you memorialize all the parties' intent in writing. You know, in the event there's a dispute, and of course we never want one, but if one arises, it's clear right there in writing, the options for both parties to resolve that dispute. So anytime you're going to have an event, make sure you have corporate sponsorship agreements. Make sure you have your contract, your service contract with any vendors. Make sure that you have your event space contract. That's so important. For the nonprofit, state compliance. Make sure you're complying with local, federal, and state agencies. You have the Secretary of State, the Attorney General, the IRS, and the Franchise Tax Board, your state taxing agency. You have more agencies than a for-profit. Instead of just two taxing agencies, you have four that you have to comply with. That's so important to know. Do you have to register with them? Do you have annual reporting requirements? And it varies, again, it varies by state drastically. So if you're going to be operating in more than one state, make sure that you are complying with all of the different state agencies.
Now,
and I think that, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, where can people, you're based in San Diego and specializing in California law, our listeners that are across the country and across North America today, where they is there a resource where they can find people with your type of expertise in the not-for-profit space? Is there a directory where they can find help locally?
You know, there is a uniform registration for attorney generals. I think it's the URI is what it's called, but it's not yet refined. So unfortunately, there's no one-stop shop yet for what all of the laws are in different states. But I have many clients that I represent that they operate in more than just California. And so many times what I'm doing for them is researching the law to tell them what the law is and then connecting them with an attorney in another law to help them comply in that state. So unfortunately, it's the hard work that you have to just research what the law is. And many times that means contacting that state agency. Pick up the phone and call them. Ask them what their requirements are or going to that state agency's website.
Okay, great. So it sounds like you are actually a great referral source for people in other states also.
Absolutely.
Now, I know that you have a lot of other background. We've talked a lot about events and event considerations. I know you have a lot of other fundraising experience as well. So are there any, you know, must-know advice that you think nonprofits should know about fundraising legal considerations, not necessarily event-based, that you can touch upon?
Sure. I mean, I think it's just important to be creative with your fundraising. Of course, there is direct solicitation of contributions and donations and grants, the very generic, what everyone would think of when you say fundraising. But I guess my piece of advice for nonprofits would be be creative. We're in the era of corporate social responsibility. It's really sexy right now. So think outside of the box and set yourself aside from other nonprofits. Set yourself apart from other nonprofits. Whether that be, you know, look at the different mediums that cause-related marketing takes form in. Maybe that's strategic partnership with a for-profit. Maybe that's a joint venture, or maybe it's a licensing arrangement, a percentage of sale, a BOGO, buy one, get one. There's so many options for you to be creative to really solicit and fundraise to your capacity to really further your charitable mission.
Mary, I've heard the term, and you just shared it with us, cause-related marketing. Specifically, what do you mean by that?
Sure. So cause-related marketing is, it can really be defined as a mutually beneficial collaboration between a for-profit and a non-profit. And it's really designed to promote the for-profit sales and the non-profit's cause. So like I said, we're in this era of social responsibility. So it's no longer what you're doing. It's more what you don't do that can cost a non-profit or a for-profit. So cause marketing, it's now the norm. The customers and consumers of the public want to know that businesses share their desire to make the world a better place by supporting an important cause. So really aligning your nonprofit with another organization, whether it be a nonprofit or a for-profit organization, to have mutual benefits for both organizations. But make sure it's a fit because consumers aren't stupid. They want to know that it makes sense with what your mission is and what is the business of the for-profit or the other nonprofit that you're aligning with.
All right. Well, this information you've shared today, Mary, has been just excellent. We thank you so very much. We'll have show notes attached. I understand that you have a special offer for us here today.
Absolutely. For all listeners, I would be happy. Anyone at my firm, For Purpose Law Group, we, again, specialize in nonprofit law. We would be happy to give a 20-minute free consultation to any caller that calls in so that we can discuss your nonprofit legal needs and how we could possibly assist you.
All right. And the way to schedule that 20-minute consultation is just to reach out to the firm. The website is forpurposelaw.com. Again, we'll have that in our show notes today. And just to recap, I guess my takeaways here today, listening to you for the first time, Mary, would be number one, seek legal advice. Number two, make sure everything is contracted. Number three, that you're well insured.
That's right. That's right. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm a good listener. All right. Thank you very much. Our guest today has been Mary Tavilla Dowling of the law firm For Purpose Law. Once again, their website is forpurposelaw.com. We'll have further information in the show notes. Thanks a lot, Mary.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of Events with Benefits. Thank you so much for joining us. If you like what you heard on today's episode, please, please rate us wherever you find your podcasts. And be sure to share this with anyone you think it can help. You can find more information about our guest and resources in the show notes at www.eventswithbenefits.com. And please stay tuned for more episodes coming up very, very soon. Thanks all, and we look forward to seeing you next time.